There's a list of words taped to the console in front of me, and I'm sure you can guess what some of them are. And if a guest lets one of them slip, my producers have to spring into action to execute a profanity dump to prevent the offending word from going out over the air. What gives these words such power that the FCC deems them unacceptable to be heard on the public airwaves? In his latest book, In Praise of Profanity, Michael Adams, a professor of English language and literature at Indiana University, looks at the history of curse words and argues that there's a real value in that kind of language. It's published by Oxford University Press, and I'm very pleased. In fact, it's a heck of an honor to welcome Michael Adams to our show now. Hello.
Hello. It's a great pleasure to be here.
You've written several books on slang. How does profanity intersect with slang? How much of slang is also profanity?
Well, it used to be, back in the Middle Ages, that profanity was words you used against God or against God's interest or in curses or that sort of thing.
Because of the Tenth Commandment? Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord in vain?
Medieval people weren't all that worried about sex and excrement. They talked about that stuff fairly freely. But you get into the modern era, words for sex and excrement are taken as obscene, and this category of profanity develops. But recently, the taboos have loosened so much that I think of most uses of what were classically profane words as a type of super expressive slang.
Some dictionaries categorize these words as vulgar. What does that mean to a linguist?
I don't know that it means anything for linguists, and I'm not sure that it's a very useful term today. It means originally of the people, and the idea was that cultured folks who were well above the people didn't use bad words. Of course they did, but we rarely categorize people today in terms of their vulgarity, and it's a sort of social judgment. It's not really a linguistic category.
What are the reasons usually given for people not to use swear words? That they're immoral? That they're offensive? Or are we trying to protect children from hearing them?
I think it's a mixture of all of those. There are groups, certainly, who believe that swearing is immoral, and they have a presumably biblical basis for that belief, and there are folks who think it's just better not to talk about sex and excrement and things like that. And there are people who believe that profanity is always somehow angry or aggressive, which I dispute in the book. I think there are lots of instances in use where there's no anger involved or any sort of aggressiveness toward another person involved in the use of profanity. And those are the uses I celebrate.
George Carlin pointed out that kids learn not to use these words by trying them out and then getting punished for saying them.
Yeah, they do. They do, except it's a lot more complicated than that. I've got a 4-year-old daughter who explained to me one day, actually before she turned 4, she was astonished at something, and she said, "What the heck?" I think she's learned this partly from friends, partly from adults, and partly from the television show My Little Pony, in which one of the ponies says, "What the hay?" all the time. And that "what the" pattern introduces profanity and euphemisms for profanity a lot of the time. She said, "Let me tell you something, Daddy," which she says to me a lot. She says, "Let me tell you something. Sometimes I say, 'What the heck?' Sometimes I just say, 'What the?'" That means she's got the grammar of profanity in her head somehow, before she can unlearn it. And I don't think that punishment is going to change her understanding of the linguistics of profanity.
The words that we're talking about are acceptable if we use the medical or scientific versions of them.
Right.
But not the four-letter or in the case of some radio stations, for example, NPR today had an interview with Amy Schumer, and she used a three-letter word for semen, and they bleeped it out.
Oh, really? And unnecessarily, well, perhaps because it would offend some viewers. And I think if you're dealing with or listeners, and if you're dealing with the mass of people, you know some people will object to terms like that. Whether we need to be prescriptive about that or not, I guess, it depends on who we think our audience is.
Wasn't the original list of 7 words a result of a Supreme Court decision about the broadcast of a George Carlin comedy routine on WBAI?
You know, that's a great question, and I'm not sure what the origin of it is.
Because because certain words are allowed, the 7 words are the words that he used in his routine, and it includes one word, which I can't say, unfortunately, but that appears regularly in a New York Times crossword puzzle.
Right. Well, true enough.
But it sounds funny, so he used it.
Yeah. And there's a set of words that we've determined socially. There's no concrete linguistic reason for it, but we've determined that saying them in public or in certain contexts carries some risk. And those are the terms that we usually count as profanity. And the FCC doesn't want us to take risks on the public airwaves, but we can take those risks and make something of them in a lot of other contexts.
A listener asks, if people curse regularly in their conversation, does that or can that profanity lose its power?
Well, that's a good question. And I suppose in the speech of an individual, it could. I think that speakers of English, for instance, or any language, intuitively know that if they were to overuse profanity, if everyone were to overuse it, the language would lose its power. But an individual could make it powerless within his or her conversation or use if there were a lot of use. I think that that notion of overuse or using it all the time is actually a pretty complicated one, because I think if you took the whole stream of language out of people's mouths and you quantified it somehow and you measured the amount of that that's profanity, even the most profane speakers you'd find use profanity at a statistically insignificant level. But it's so loaded as language that whenever it's spoken, we immediately hear it in the way we don't hear, say, prepositions or articles or much more frequently used words or even common nouns and such. So I think that the shock value of it actually causes us to overestimate the amount of profanity we're hearing.
Although you write that we're living in an age of profanity.
I think we are, because I think we've got to the point where you can use profanity fairly freely, but the taboo is not entirely removed. There's still enough risk in using profanity that it can be especially expressive.
Are we seeing a relaxation of language standards in some media like TV and magazines? For example, you look specifically at The New Yorker. When William Shawn was the editor, none of these words were allowed. But when Tina Brown took over, she changed all of that.
Editor, that's right. And writers had to struggle with Shawn about that. And they were considered the last bastion against profanity, since most other major, even literary and news magazines had begun to allow profanity into their pages. But that is sort of a point at which the tide turns, because cable television follows it, and cable television is full of profanity, and even network television includes lots of gestures toward profanity so that a knowing audience quickly understands that profanity is part of the context.
But in the case of cable, it's only the premium channels, the ones that we pay for, allow it. So there's a double standard there.
Yeah, it does say that people with money can hear profanity and people without money probably don't. And it gets back to the question that you brought up earlier about who's enjoying the profanity, the vulgar people, the people who are at the base of the population economically and politically, or people who are privileged. People of privilege have been able to use profanity with impunity for a long time, but the assumption is that because they're educated, because they have power, they know how to use it. They carry a license for profanity that ordinary people don't. I think that the earlier myth was that vulgar people use profanity, not that use of profanity automatically made you vulgar.
As part of your research, you counted the number of expletives per episode of The Sopranos.
Yes, I did.
Does that show hold a record? Obviously, that was intended to show that these people were real thugs.
Yeah, it does. But, you know, I did not do, mainly because I couldn't bear sitting in front of the television and counting more profanity. I didn't do another show as a contrast. And I think if you went to 6 Feet Under, for instance, which was roughly contemporary with The Sopranos, that show is full of profanity, too. I think it could probably give The Sopranos a run for its money. But it is astonishing. It was astonishing to me in the case of The Sopranos, in which an episode ran roughly 53 minutes, that you could have as many as 170 profanities uttered in a single episode. That was unusually high, but it was normal for there to be more profanities than there were minutes of airtime.
Who decides what words are allowed and which ones aren't on over the airwaves, radio, and television. Does each station or network have a committee, or is this totally the province of the FCC?
My understanding when it comes to prohibiting the language is that it comes down to the FCC, but you get a lot of network self-censorship as a result of that. I think, though, that the pay cable networks have demonstrated, they've just demonstrated a tremendous freedom, and I don't know if they feel anything but an artistic restraint in incorporating profanity into their shows.
Social media and texting have developed a system of abbreviations or acronyms for these words, OMG, LMAO, WTF, which allow us to use them without being censored. Did those abbreviations arise more for reasons of economy than discretion or politeness?
Well, it's a very important convergence of the two, and because you're writing often intimately in those settings, you want to share the profanity with people you know, but often people see what you're writing who are not your intimates, and so maybe a little bit of politeness is useful, or you're just bowing to the tendency of the general order that you should be polite online. I think we all know that if you are aggressive online, it can get you into a lot of trouble. So this is a way of masking anything that might be seen as aggressive. But 140 characters, too, is 140 characters, and you don't have time for a lot of verbose profanity in that setting.
How has it changed in just regular publishing? Norman Mailer had his soldiers use a word similar to the F word in Naked and the Dead. But was it court cases that finally decided that James Joyce or Henry Miller or what we see commonly in every book that is aimed at adults today, is that what freed up the publishers?
Yeah, there were finally court cases that freed up the publishers and determined that that obscenity was no longer outlawed. As it was still when Mailer began to write. Lots of people had read D.H. Lawrence and James Joyce through smuggled copies of the books, but they're famous cases of those smugglers being caught, and that's how the obscenity came into the courts, is in the defense of those book smugglers.
You've called your book In Praise of Profanity. What do you see as praiseworthy about this kind of language?
Well, there are a couple of things. One of them is that when you are at the... I think that people speak the way they speak for a reason, and it's my business to try to figure out what the reasons are, and I'm often not worried about the quality of speech, and yet sometimes the language we're given, just everyday English, is inadequate, and so we use slang, which can be colorful and supply something on the fly that otherwise we would find it difficult to say. Existentially, when we're as frustrated as we can possibly be, we cry out and we're looking for a word that serves the emotional release we need or expresses that frustration. And everyday vocabulary won't do that. You cannot say, oh, I am really terrifically frustrated right now, and get the same effect that you get from crying out an expletive. And I think in that situation, it's almost like drama, isn't it? It's almost like the tragicomedy of life, that somebody who's dropped all their stuff into a puddle in the middle of a rainstorm, who emits that cry, you say, with a smile on your face, boy, that person's having a really bad day. And there's a poetry to that.
Europeans have laxer laws, rules on this, and every once in a while a foreign guest will use a word that we don't allow because it's allowed in their country. So are Americans particularly uptight about this?
They're particularly uptight about that type of sexual excremental profanity. I mean, you can get into trouble using profanity that seems non-religious or anti-religious. You can say tabernacle in French, and somebody will find that more profane, as it literally is, than using something like the F word or the S word. But you know, every country has its own rules about what counts as polite and what doesn't count as polite, and Americans have got theirs, and they tend to still attach a certain amount of risk to public profanity.
Although we even have, context is important, and who's saying it is important. A listener who's white says his black friends use the N-word all the time, and he wonders if, since he doesn't, it all has a weighted meaning for himself, a different meaning for himself than for them.
Yeah, it does, and that's actually an interesting case because linguists would say that a certain subset of the African-American community has reappropriated or reclaimed that word so that other people can't use it against them, so that they have control over it, and you can use it as a term of endearment in some subgroups of the African-American population. You can also, with words like the B word, I've noticed recently the C word, which has been very much frowned upon in American speech for a long time, and yet both in television and fiction recently I found scenes where younger women are using the C word in order to form some sort of intimacy.
So do words have a different meaning depending on whether the speaker is male or female?
It would. I would never use the C word. It's for young women to reclaim if they want to, and there'll be plenty of women who think it's a bad idea to try to reclaim that word, just as there were lots of African Americans who thought that it was a bad idea to reclaim the N word in the way that young African American men did, at least for a while. We'll just have to see whether this C word trend takes off or whether it's just an idea in writers' minds right now.
And I would never use that word or any of the other seven words because the FCC will fine WNYC if I do, and
yeah.
They will. And if you had used one of those words and we hadn't dumped it, we would have to pay for that as well.
Yeah, luckily the costs are less for the most part in other contexts, other speech contexts.
Michael Adams is a professor of English language and literature at Indiana University, Bloomington. He's the editor of the quarterly journal American Speech, president-elect of the Dictionary Society of America, the author of a number of books. The one we've been discussing is In Praise of Profanity, and the cover has all sorts of words spelled differently so that we wouldn't think of them as profane. It is published by Oxford University Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks so much for having me.